Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please also get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes throughout the show. We always start out with looking at some debt-related news and facts for the week. This week, from Washington, nearly half of homeowners in loan modifications is actually a much-hyped conclusion of these foreclosure prevention programs. Relying on voluntary loan modifications, these foreclosure prevention programs are failing to reach a significant number of troubled homeowners and are often backfiring when they do so, according to newly updated research released this week by the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys. The across-the-board failure of these much-ballyhooed fixes for the foreclosure crisis are expected to result in the new president and Congress facing considerable new pressure to clear the way for court-supervised loan modifications that will prove more beneficial for homeowners. The findings released last week by NACMA come on the heels of a dire new projection from Credit Suisse that over 8 million foreclosures are now expected over the next 4 years in the United States. This astounding level accounts for 16% of all mortgages, including 59% of all subprime mortgages, and more than 11% of all other mortgages, including Alt-A, ARMs, and even those in the prime category. This new forecast from Credit Suisse is up sharply from the 2 to 6 million foreclosure range cited in previous estimates from industry sources. The new data presented from Professor Alan White of Valparaiso University School of Law in Indiana is updated through November of 2008 and shows that less than 10% of the time do the voluntary programs result in a reduced principal loan, with more than half of the modifications capitalizing unpaid interest and fees into larger and more drawn-out debt at the back end of the mortgage, and only about a third, 35%, of voluntary mortgage modifications reduce monthly payment burdens for homeowners, with nearly half, 45%, actually saddling distressed homeowners with increased payments under the modifications. Just how badly are the voluntary modification programs flopping? To answer that question, NACBA reviewed the publicly available data about the much-hyped programs. In one prominent case, the Hope for Homeowners Act, FHA, refinancing program passed by Congress with much fanfare earlier this year on the strength of forecasts that 400,000 homeowners would be aided, there have only been 312 applications to date, and no mortgage modification whatsoever has taken place. This is consistent with the most recent estimates from the National Association of Attorneys General that nearly 8 out of 10 seriously delinquent homeowners are not on track for any loss mitigation outcome, up from 7 in 10 in previous reports. Henry Summer, president of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, said, quote, court-supervised loan modification is urgently needed to deal with this problem. We call on the incoming Obama administration and the new Congress to adopt this solution without delay. The American home mortgage foreclosure crisis has gone from the danger zone to the full-blown crisis stage. The number of foreclosures is growing rapidly and is reaching well beyond the subprime world to the American middle class. Despite a proliferation of voluntary programs, we are not seeing evidence of a meaningful number of sustainable loan modifications. Professor Alan White of Valparaiso University School of Law said American homeowners are carrying $10.5 trillion in mortgage debt, a number that has risen by 250% in the past decade. While banks have written down more than half a trillion in mortgages and mortgage-related securities, homeowners have gotten little or no relief. A broad range of economists, from Nouriel Roubini to Ben Bernanke to Martin Feldstein, have recognized the need to deleverage the American homeowner. The excess mortgage debt is depressing home prices and consumer spending and acting as a drag on the broader economy. Empirical evidence from mortgage servicer reports to investors show that, for the most part, the necessary deleveraging of homeowners is just not happening. Alice Cohn, staff attorney for the National Consumer Law Center in Washington, D.C., said, quote, "Sadly, the magnitude of the foreclosure crisis dwarfs the response to date from the financial services industry, regulators, and lawmakers. The lack of aggressive and meaningful solutions from federal policymakers is baffling, particularly given that most economists, including the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board and the chair of the FDIC, have recognized that the financial crisis can be resolved by only dealing with its root cause, the escalating millions of mortgage foreclosures. The foreclosure crisis will not be resolved through voluntary efforts on the part of the financial services industry alone. Despite widespread efforts to encourage voluntary loan modifications, it is clear that the financial services industry has failed to implement a loan modification strategy on a scale that matches the urgent crisis we are facing. Bankruptcy courts must be empowered to implement economically rational loan modifications where the parties are unwilling or unable to do so on their own. Loan modifications through the bankruptcy courts can help accomplish this on a sufficient scale and time frame to have a meaningful impact. Congress should lift the ban on judicial modification of primary residence mortgages as part of the solution to stemming the tide of avoidable foreclosures and stabilizing the housing market and the broader economy. The need is urgent. The time for action is now." And the reason for this response is because when NACBA, NCLC, Consumer Federation of America, and the Center for Responsible Lending called on Congress in April 2007 to move aggressively to stem the growing flood of home foreclosures, it was estimated that some 2 million homeowners were at risk of foreclosure. And at the time, the financial services industry accused these organizations of being overly pessimistic about the likely toll of foreclosures. However, it turns out they were quite lowballing significantly the number of foreclosures. As of September 2008, a full 1.2 million homeowners with subprime loans already had lost their homes to foreclosure. Another 1.7 million families with subprime loans are seriously delinquent and at risk of foreclosure in the very near future. Yet Credit Suisse foreclosure update shows 8 million foreclosures are going to be happening, 8.1 million that is, will be in foreclosure over the next 4 years, representing 16% of all mortgages in America. Disturbingly, Credit Suisse finds that the problem has spread from subprime loans to Alt-A, option ARMs, and even prime loans. Failure of foreclosure prevention program is causing this outcome. And the reason for this is that many of these mortgages have multiple owners. That makes voluntary modification impossible. There is a fear of investor lawsuits blocking voluntary modifications. Many of the mortgages are piggyback second mortgages, which block voluntary modifications. There are overwhelming conditions for the servicers of the mortgage because they're not set up to negotiate modifications. And finally, the belief that the investors and the servicers and the holders of the mortgages will voluntarily take a loss is really naive and is certainly not happening. So in a nutshell, NACPA's response is that the bankruptcy courts, the judges, should be given the responsibility to review these situations individually and to create compromises. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Continuing on, let's go over to our educational side of the program and discuss how to deal with debt. What we've been discussing last few weeks has been the savings component stage of debt dealing. But before I get going, I just want to start, as always, with the credit to Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on their work, theories, and books. And as far as books are concerned, I highly recommend their two prominent books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. Pick these up, they really would be a great benefit, not just only for reviewing what I've been doing here, but as a textbook and a handbook to run your life by. That is, of course, your financial life, but it does have an outpouring into all of your facets of living, your relationships, and even your health. I'll start with a review of what we went over last week, the new material. You can also always go to the archives at www.kruufm.com. Look at Life and Debt, and you can get virtually all the shows that I have recorded, giving you an education on how to handle your debt, and once that's done, how to create some wealth for yourself. We're in the saving stage of your future and creating a lifetime of wealth by having a retirement savings plan, paying off your house mortgage, and saving for your other dreams. And one of the areas we discussed last week, which is very important, is the concept of your investing in stocks. You can go back into former shows to get into the details of the stock concept. However, last week, the one point that we really emphasized was to do all your stock investment with what Professor Warren calls one-stop shopping. And in a technical sense, it's called an index fund. It's really the easiest way to put your savings money into a conservative and safe area of investment. An index fund, sometimes also called an indexed mutual fund, what happens is these funds buy stocks from hundreds of different companies and get you instant, no-hassle diversification, which is extraordinarily important in creating some safety net for yourself and protecting your savings for the long-range retirement program or to do other things with that money in the meantime. Stocks are purchased in index funds according to a preset formula. You're not blowing a bunch of money paying some high-priced specialist to sit around and dream about the next big stock. The index fund just buys a little bit of stock from different companies indexed on the stock market and then lets you sit back and lets the money grow. There's very little overhead fees when you do this, and you are really getting outperformance of almost all the other stock funds that you can invest in and the loser kind of whopper deals that the majority of people invest in with brokers on Wall Street. This is not the best idea for people, particularly in the current condition of the stock market as things are going lower and lower in terms of value. What you want to do is have a long-term savings plan and put that money into the stock investments that are indexed mutual funds. I pointed out last week that really the greatest financial wizards like Warren Buffett said that the best way to own common stocks is through an indexed mutual fund. Peter Lynch, the vice chairman of Fidelity, a legendary stock picker, also supported this by saying most individual investors would be better off in an indexed mutual fund. So on and on, we just see this, that indexed mutual funds are a great place to put your money, and that they're not going to make a whole lot of money for the brokers or for the magazines that are trying to create the high return, instant, short-term investment options for creating wealth for themselves. But this is to create a long-term, stable wealth for you. So if you don't learn anything else from this show, just this one point, indexed mutual funds is where you want to put your savings. And how do you choose an indexed fund? Well, the important thing is that you look for one that has a low annual fee and includes a lot of different stocks. What we said last week is that the most popular index funds are based on the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, which is including stock from the 500 largest companies in America. Some of those are struggling at this point, but that still is the place to put your money. In essence, these firms make up 70% of the value in the entire U.S. stock market. So it's a nice broad cut of the biggest companies in America, and it gives you more diversification than if you try to pick up on smaller companies one at a time, specializing in this or specializing in that. If you are feeling a little bit more inclined to diversification, greater diversification, then you might get an indexed fund that includes the 5,000 or so companies in the entire stock market. You'll have to pay higher fees for that, but it is also a very good return over 5, 10, 15 years, looking 10 to 12%, regardless of what's happening in the rise and fall of the stock market. You will undoubtedly, historically, statistically, have those proven returns. And with that too, with that thinking, you can also opt for an index fund that includes stock companies based outside the United States, which gives you, again, a greater possible diversification, and it overcomes some of the financial issues that the American dollar is having at this point. The other thing we discussed was where should you buy an index fund, and the conclusion was that index funds are basically all the same, and you should choose the place that will give you the lowest possible fee, which are really the overhead fees for the fund. You can get an index fund through your retirement plan or as a standalone investment. And if you're shopping on your own, discount brokerages are a good place to start, which you can find online. Just hunt for the lowest fees. If you're getting your retirement plan through your job, you can choose from the list of investment options your employer gives you. If there is an index fund on the list, just sign up for it. If there's no index fund on the list, look for the most diversified, low-cost mutual fund you can find, which is really the best way to replicate the benefits of an index fund. And also, you should go to your employer and say, hello, let's get an index mutual fund in our retirement plan for next year. I think that would be a benefit not only to you, but to everyone else in the company who has that retirement plan. Another thing we discussed last week is the idea of, can I just keep my money in the bank? And we looked at this in a mathematical sense, and it may seem very, very conservative to take your 20% of your disposable monthly income, which is your savings component of our plan, and just putting it in the savings account. But actually, by looking at the outcome, if you're able to take that 20%, put it in an index fund, and then leave it there for a long period of time, just for example, we said $50,000, and that was the basic earnings of an individual, and they take the 20% of their disposable monthly income, keep it away for 20 years or 25 years like that, they would be netting nearly $1 million total, the savings plus the interest on that income after that 25 years. Whereas if you were to have a savings account and you're earning 3%, which a lot of them aren't even earning that nowadays, you will have nowhere near $1 million in that account at the end of 25 years. You'd have more like $200,000, $220,000. So just sitting there, letting the money grow, one way to do it in an effective outcome is to put it in your index fund, and the other to do it in an ineffective, very meager outcome is to just leave it in the savings account. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we're talking about index mutual funds and some questions related to them. And the last question that we dealt with last week, and actually the week before that too, is what do I do when the market crashes? Well, you see it now. It's all over the news. The Dow Jones is falling. The market is crashing. Brokers are jumping out of windows. What should I do? And the response from Professor Warren and from me is that you do nothing. Do nothing. And you say, well, that can't be serious. Well, the truth is that you don't respond to the ups and downs of the market with long-term investments. Selling when the market starts to fall is a mistake. But buying when the market starts to fall is actually a very good outcome in the long run. The odds are in your favor. So the roller coaster ride is there, and it can make people dizzy, but we don't look at it on a daily basis as if we're some trader. This is a long haul investment, and the smartest economists and Nobel laureates in the world, plus the factual statistics, show that year after year, you will be making some money. It'll go up a little bit, it'll go down a little bit, but over a long period of time, if you sit tight and you keep on investing, you will be making money when the stock market turns around, which it will. There's no doubt that it will. So let's continue with some new questions in the same area for this week in investing in stocks. You say to yourself, but I know this certain company, XYZ, will do great. Why don't I just put all of my money into it? Because they have a great product, their profits are rising. Why not throw all of my money into that company? Well, the problem with that is you're not the only one who has noticed that the company has a great product. In fact, there are literally thousands upon thousands of professional investors who spend all their working hours testing products and checking profits. Odds are they know that it's a good company and they've already bid up the price of the stock, which means that you probably won't make any more money buying that stock than you would any other. Many well-respected economists believe that even the smartest, most dedicated investors are likely to lose money when they try to pick up individual stocks. As one great Nobel laureate in economics, Professor Paul Samuelson of MIT, said, "It's not easy to get rich in Las Vegas, at Churchill Downs, or at the local Merrill Lynch office. Don't put all your money in your employer's stock, for example. You work for them, you think that's a great company, but with all of these single company investments, the truth is that sometimes bad things do happen to good companies. Just remember Enron. Thousands of employees got burned from Enron. They lost their jobs and their retirement accounts were wiped out because they hadn't diversified. And this kind of thing is happening for more and more companies, and it doesn't matter how small or big they are in terms of their stability. The economy is struggling and many, many employees are getting the brunt of the employer's difficulties, whereas the employer's CEOs are making off with huge severance funds of hundreds of millions of dollars at times. And this is going on and on with stock options and whatever, but the people who work there are getting the downside as the stock value plummets. So keep the idea of diversification clear in your mind, and then the bottom line is the indexed mutual fund. Now, you may want to play the stock market, and that's a wonderful thing to do if it is something that you feel you're smart and you're savvy and you're highly motivated to do something like that. But you should not do this as an investor with your investment. You can do it as a hobby. Don't play the market with your retirement fund. It's just for fun. It's not for your future. And along the same line, you may have a financial investor who says that you should invest in that single company. Many of us do feel uncertain about financial planning, and we do seek out the help of professionals, and there are a lot of good professionals there. But the point is that you need to be careful. Financial planners and stockbrokers aren't really any different from car salesmen. They make their money off getting you to buy something. If you don't buy, they don't earn. So they sell you something that you really need, like a retirement account, that's great. However, they often try to steer you towards high-priced investments that yield the fattest commissions for them and not the best returns for you. They can be very slick salespersons and come up with elaborate reasons why the high-fee mutual fund is better than an index fund. But the bottom line is, before you sign on that dotted line, ask your broker what his or her commission is. And if you're not comfortable with what they're saying, the solution is to take a walk out the door. A couple other points is that there are some investments to avoid if you are getting into these non-diversified areas of investment in particular, even as a hobby. And that's one, forms of exotic currency exchange, gold, silver, otherwise. This is great, again, as a diversified investment, but not as a all my eggs in one basket kind of investment. Let the guys with lots of money to lose play that kind of investment. Another area is, believe it or not, is prepaid funerals. That's a lot of money going to a funeral home for years and years. Your money's tied up and there's no way to earn any return on it. It's an important thing in your life, but it's better just to write a will, leave instructions and cash, and then your loved ones can take care of it. Some of the largest funeral homes throughout America have filed bankruptcy, and with the economy, that's an area that could go under. Even if you've given them money, you would just lose it. A third area is collectibles as an investment. This is not really savings kinds of investments. Huge amounts of money are not going to be made from this, whether you're buying comic books or coins or rare stamps or baseball cards or antique furniture, first edition books, classic cars, all these kinds of things make money for the sellers. And in some rare, ultra-rich situation, those very wealthy people can capitalize on these investments and make money. And of course, they're highly discussed in the news, but they're not there for anything other than a hobby or for fun. They're not the cornerstone of your future savings. Remember, your retirement, your future, your money belongs in an index fund and not, frankly, a comic book fund. And the last thing I'd like to discuss today is sending your kid to college. There is a thing called a 529 college savings plan, which is a tax-free kind of investment that you can put money in and you have your savings opportunity. What you want to do is take some of the money in that plan, and what you do is you just put the money into the plan, which you can get from any state in the United States. And the investment grows tax-free. The IRS won't take anything out of that fund. Your family gets to keep it all. The second thing is that you maintain control over the account. You decide when to distribute the money, how much to give it out of that account, even though it's in your child's name. So that's a very good advantage. A third point is that you can take it back. You can discover that one day you need the money for another purpose. So it's really hard to beat a 529 plan. There is a penalty, 10% of the earnings on the money, but you can take back the gift anytime you want. And your child may grow up and get a scholarship or decide not to go to college for a while or at all, and you can shift the money to another sibling without any penalty. And fourth point is that it's really, really easy because, as I said, each state offers its own 529 plan, and you can sign up for any of them regardless of where you live and regardless of where your child ultimately goes to college. And once you've picked a plan, you just complete a simple enrollment form and start saving. And the bottom line here is that college is really, really expensive nowadays. So you want to start saving for it, for your kids, as soon and early as possible. Right now is a good time. And of course, when your kid gets to college, he or she may need to work part-time to pay for some of the things that they need for college, or they may get a scholarship or grant money. But the 529 savings plan is part of the total picture, and every dollar you save is another dollar towards bringing this dream a little closer. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com.